From the Virginia Quarterly Review. And on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which produces the Virginia Festival of the Book, I'd like to welcome everyone to this, the annual celebration of literacy and books. Many organizations make themselves program sponsors, hosts, and supporters of festival events. At this event, we'd like to thank the UVA Bookstore and the Virginia Quarterly Review for bringing in Pauline. In addition, we thank the hundreds of volunteers who plan, promote, and staff festival events. Please help with the efforts of these volunteers by filling out a program evaluation form and returning it to one of the volunteers at the exits as you leave. They're waving in the back. That really is an important part of all of this. It helps tracking the attendance and the response to the events, and that helps in turn with the funding for the events. So if you enjoy what you see, just taking a minute or two to fill out those forms will assure that there are programs like this again next year. Also, please remember that there are copies of Pauline's book and the current issue, the just arrived issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review with a new essay of Pauline's on sale. And these sales support both the authors and the booksellers like the UVA Bookstore who help make the festival possible. So again, if you enjoy what you hear, I hope you'll buy a book, buy a copy of the magazine, and help to sponsor future events. Now, as I mentioned, and as all of you know from looking at the program, it's our pleasure to have with us today Dr. Pauline W. Chen, the author of Final Exam. What you may not know is something that we're quite proud of, that Pauline published first with us in the Virginia Quarterly Review. I wish we could take a little bit more credit for it than we can, unfortunately. Pauline's agent submitted her essay Dead Enough to us, an essay about brain death from the standpoint of a transplant surgeon, the difficulties of informing the families, the difficulties of drawing that line. I read the essay and was deeply moved and impressed by it. I walked the few short steps to Kevin Morrissey's desk. Kevin is hiding in the back. Gave him the essay to read, and he returned shortly thereafter and said, "We have to publish this." And that was about as much work as we had to do with Pauline to get her into our pages. Since then, she's continued to be really generous with her work with us. The final chapter of Final Exam appeared with us, and as I mentioned, there's a new essay of hers also in the current issue. I encourage you to seek out these essays of hers that are not featured in the book. They're every bit as strong as the book itself. The book, you may know, has done quite well for Pauline, and deservedly so. She writes with a great deal of sensitivity, insight, and she writes from personal experience in a way that I think helps humanize the experience of doctors, even as she's attempting to describe and humanize the experience of dying and death. It's an extremely important enterprise that she's embarked on, and I think she's had an incredible beginning, and we expect even greater things from her in the future. Please join me in welcoming Pauline Chen.
Thank you, Ted. I hope I can live up to that introduction this afternoon. I want to thank Ted and the Virginia Quarterly Review and the Virginia Festival of the Book and the UVA Bookstore for inviting me here. This is a real honor to be in Charlottesville. People often ask how this book came about, whether this was something that I had planned to write from medical school on, whether this was something that I consciously went about collecting stories for. But in truth, it just sort of came of its own accord. I've always liked to write. But I never, during residency, during medical school, I really had no time to write. We were so busy that if I had free time, I usually chose the more primal needs like eating and sleeping over writing. So the writing really, really took a backseat. I wrote some letters that I never sent. I wrote a few journal entries. But when I finished training, that was 9 years of training after medical school, I found myself drawn again to writing. And I found myself writing short stories, fictional short stories, almost, I would say, obsessively. I'd write them on pieces of paper that I found on the wards. I'm a little embarrassed to say this, if there were blank sheets of paper in the back of patient charts, I'd pull them out and scribble things, stick them in my pocket. I wrote in notebooks, I wrote in my computer. And after a few months of this, I realized that I needed to do something to maybe harness these impulses a bit. So I took a couple of writing courses at UCLA. And during the second writing course, the teacher came up to me and said, "Pauline, we need to talk." I thought, oh no, she's probably angry because I've missed so many classes because I've had to transplant, or because the details of my stories were too graphic, the clinical details. But instead, what she said to me that afternoon, and it was a beautiful afternoon, it was like this. She said, "Pauline, you need to write these stories." And I have to say that I think after she said that to me, that somehow those words gave me the permission to write what I really wanted to write. And those were the stories, the narratives about patients I had cared for over the last 10 or so years, some of whom I was still grieving over. And stories about the way that I cared for patients, and I was probably grieving over that as well. But after she said that to me, I went about writing these stories in a little more organized fashion. And those stories, at least the ones that kept coming back to me, that kept, for lack of a better word, haunting my consciousness, those stories form the core of Final Exam. There are a lot of different themes that I touch on in Final Exam, but one of them is the professionalization of physicians, how we go from being medical students who want, oftentimes very passionately, to help people, to help our patients, how we go from that through, then go through this incredible training process. And it really is an incredible training process when you think about the thousands of doctors that come out at the end, and all of them are pretty well trained, consistently, uniformly. But how we go through that, and at the very end up probably as far as you could be from the very people we set out to help. We can't talk to them anymore. We speak a different language. And many of them don't really want to talk to us. So what I look at in this book is that process. What happens? And specifically, what happens to one of the people that went through the process, me. I'd like to read two sections from the book today that show you a little bit of how the process took place in me. The first section starts actually before I was born, and the second section is toward the end of my training. My mother and father arrived in the United States some 3 years before my birth, part of a cadre of young Taiwanese scholars who graduated from the country's most competitive university. They had secured graduate student scholarships at prestigious American universities and then passed the grueling Taiwanese national exam for exit visas. In old family albums, there are photos of my parents at the airport in Taipei as they are about to start their lives abroad. Each is adorned with leis of white orchids and flanked by dozens of relatives squinting against the tropical sun. Within 3 years, however, my parents' lives were as bleak as the January skies of New England. They lived in the third floor of a poorly maintained Cambridge triple-decker, were regular clients of the local Salvation Army thrift store, and ate lunches of a homemade steamed bread that my mother made yellow and marginally more nutritious by adding an egg. My father worked as a teaching assistant, while my mother waited tables and then, as a bank clerk, handled the money that others seemed to have so much of, and she so little. And each month, they dutifully sent most of their income to my father's struggling family. In those early years together, their single greatest investment was a used bike. Even during the snowy winters, to save on the 10-cent bus fares, they rode to school together on that bike. My father pedaled up front, and my mother, head covered in a scarf and arms wrapped around my father's waist, sat side saddle on the back fender. It was into this graduate student poverty, on a cool fall morning in 1964, that I was born, with as much parental dread as loving anticipation. It did not help matters that I was also born backward, feet first. The youngest and most inexperienced doctor at the hospital attended my mother initially, but as the parade of obstetricians became more professorial, as it became clearer that I was unlikely to turn around in utero before emerging. My mother, who did not know enough English to understand their concerned pronouncements, clung to a piece of moist gauze, quietly clenching it between her teeth as I descended. She had delivered, my grandmother later commented, like a Japanese princess. Despite their limited incomes, one of the first things my parents did after my birth was to send a small bundle abroad. I've often suspected that this act was a splurge, but to my parents, mailing this package was more important than any winter bus ride, cafeteria-bought meal, or brand new coat. To them, it was as significant as my birth. When my maternal grandmother received this package in Taipei, she brought the contents, a letter with the date and exact time of my birth, and a piece of clothing that my mother had worn during her pregnancy, to an elderly man who lived at the edge of the city. I have often imagined him, a wizened individual in black cotton shoes with wispy strands of white hair growing from his chin, a curling pinky fingernail, and a sleepy expression accentuated by the drag of gravity. According to my parents, that old man, a fortune teller famous in Taiwan, inspected the items and then began writing on a small scroll in meticulous Chinese script about the trials and tribulations of my life to come. He commented on my health, chronicled my studies, and described the riches that would and would not come my way. He wrote that I would be a wild horse, and because the traveling star had ascended during my birth, I would have difficulty staying put. At the end of the scroll, the old man wrote a few characters alluding to my death. There are, however, no specifics, no date, no time, and not even a word about the way in which I will die. I have never seen the scroll. Somewhere along its journey from Taipei to that Cambridge triple-decker and to the half-dozen other places my parents eventually moved, it was lost. Nonetheless, those predictions have become woven into my life like a birthmark, always present, but obvious only when I care to look. In the course of my life, I have tended to look to that scroll pretty frequently. When I went to college, when I went to medical school, and when I moved around for my clinical training. I thought about those predictions when I got married, and they were foremost on my mind in the birthing room when I first heard the times of my twin daughters' births. But the scroll and the fortune teller came back to me most vividly one night during my third year of medical school. It was the night I first pronounced a patient dead. I was spending the month working with Bill, a shy, doughy intern with a reputation for clinical efficiency and a weakness for food. Each morning, Bill, the members of the medical team, and I left rounds with prodigious amounts of scut, some clinically useful tasks, to do. From the moment we dispersed, Bill was a man on a mission, checking off each item on his personal scut list. Draw blood, write orders, schedule studies, retrieve reports, with unerring efficiency. By 2 o'clock every afternoon, and several hours before everyone else on the team, Bill would be done with his scut. Without fail, I could find him celebrating on a call room bed, surrounded by his beeper, portable television, and a few bags of junk food. Sometime in the middle of that month, during another call night together, Bill paged me to the ICU. "Hey, Pauline," Bill said when I arrived. "One of the patients just died. The nurses need a death note so they can send the body down to the morgue and get the room cleaned." Bill signaled for me to follow him. I remembered my grandfather and my gross anatomy cadaver. And my grandfather was so beloved, and my cadaver submerged in formaldehyde for so long, that neither could count as a real dead body. As we walked toward the room, I remembered a story from junior high school. A fellow hospital volunteer was transporting a patient's dead body to the autopsy labs when the corpse suddenly sat up on the gurney, causing the candy striper to scream and run away. It was rigor mortis, a doctor later told me. Now I wanted to know how long it would be before rigor mortis set into this body. But when I looked over at Bill to ask, he seemed bored, tired, and not the least bit interested in medical students' stupid questions in the middle of the night. And no one else around us seemed to care either. The nurses at the station continued to write their progress notes and dispense medications. The unit secretary announced she was going on break and asked a nurse to cover the phone while she was away. Bill and I walked into the patient's room together. I could hear the soft buzz of the fluorescent lights overhead and the echo of our footsteps. The patient was an elderly Caucasian man who had small islands of white flakes on his gray skin. His parched lips had relaxed to form the letter O, and his tongue was lolling to one side. Bill pointed to the mouth. Q sign, he whispered, opening his own mouth and letting his tongue hang out on one side. I spied a few beads of sweat just above Bill's eyebrows. Go to the last page on the chart, he said, wiping the sweat away with the back of his hand. Okay, I whispered back, not quite sure why both of us were whispering. There are three things you need to check when you declare death, Bill said. His efficiency was creeping in. He had a way of reducing every single clinical task to a series of steps. First, there have to be no spontaneous heartbeats. Bill placed the bell of his stethoscope against the center of the patient's chest, listened for a minute, and then motioned for me to do the same. I heard the whooshing of my own pulse, the ocean in an empty seashell. After a few seconds, Bill continued his whispered instructions. Then you need to make sure there are no spontaneous breaths. I wondered how long the two of us would have to stand in that room watching the dead man's chest, waiting for it to rise and fall. But before I could ask, Bill snapped the stethoscope earpieces back in his ears and placed the bell once more against the man's chest. I copied him obediently, and again heard only the ocean. Satisfied by the silence, Bill shoved his stethoscope back into his coat pocket. Lastly, he said, his whisper slowly giving way to a normal talking voice, there must be no response to painful stimuli. What do you mean by painful stimuli? I wanted to ask. But before I even opened my mouth, Bill was twisting the papery skin of the dead man's hand between his own fleshy thumb and index finger. You can pinch their skin, you can roll a pencil against their fingernails, you can pinch their nipples, anything that gets a rise out of people. He released the skin and looked at me. It was my turn to inflict pain. I reached for the part of the man closest to me and least intrusive, his right middle finger. I squeezed the nail bed. Bill began laughing. That wouldn't get a rise out of me, and I'm a lot more alive than this guy. Bill grabbed my hand and laid it over the dead man's left nipple. I couldn't bear to squeeze that small pointed piece of flesh, so I tweaked some of the skin just to the side. It was warm, pliant even, but felt unconnected, like the skin of supermarket chicken. Bill pointed to the patient's chart. "Write this," he directed. "It's what you need to write in death notes, just a few sentences. No spontaneous heartbeat, no spontaneous breaths, no response to painful stimuli. Patient pronounced dead at..." Bill stopped and looked up at the clock. It was 2:23 a.m. The scraggly fortune teller popped into my head. I saw him dipping his pointed brush into the inkwell and pulling small measured strokes across the paper. "What do you think?" Bill asked me. "He's probably been dead for about 15 minutes. He paused for a moment. "Why don't you write that the patient died at 2:08 a.m.? The old fortune teller disappeared. Dutifully, I wrote what Bill said and then signed my name. Bill countersigned the note and walked back with me to the nursing station. "See, Pauline," he said as he put away the chart. "Now you know how to declare someone dead." He smiled broadly. "Isn't it easy?" I nodded. That night, I could not fall asleep. For the first time since beginning medical school, I felt like a real doctor. I heard over and over again in my head, "Dr. Chen pronounced the patient dead at 2:08 a.m. And I kept thinking about the 10 minutes I had spent in the room with Bill. I wanted to relive every detail of what I had done. By the morning, I was exhausted. I went on rounds, did my scut, but in my sleep-deprived haze began to feel off-kilter. The more I thought about the previous night, the less I felt doctorly. I began to feel angry with Bill for reducing a man's death to 3 steps and guilty for being complicit in the act. I wanted to go back to the chart, tear out my note, and write something more appropriate, longer, and more thoughtful than 3 steps. The more I thought about that death note, the more discombobulated I became. It was as if my world, spinning around along its usual trajectory, had slowed to a wobble. That afternoon, as I was about to find Bill, the old man popped into my head again, as he would in the future every time I looked at a clock to pronounce a patient dead. And suddenly, I understood why. I had insinuated my hand into that mysterious nexus of stars and fate and destiny, and I had reduced that great passing of life into an arbitrarily calculated moment in time. So that first experience declaring a patient dead was quite difficult for me. It was difficult to reconcile what I felt innately and what I was being trained to feel or to how I was being trained to approach it. But over the course of 9 years, I have to say, not with pride, but truthfully, that I acquired a lot of what Bill was teaching me. Death became another event, a pretty unremarkable event in our lives, and a common event, and one that was easy to declare. So the next section from the book that I'd like to read you is from the end of my training, the last year. And I was in the midst of a transplant fellowship, so I'd finished my general surgery training and was learning how to be a transplant surgeon. And one of our responsibilities was procuring organs from brain-dead patients. And initially, like any operation, it was difficult. But after a while, the procedure became, again, like any operation, relatively routine. So I'd like to read to you a little bit about that. And I think it also shows you how focused you can become, how you can be trained to become so focused that you really forget about the important things at hand. In my second year of transplant training, 2-year-old Michael spent a week waiting in our intensive care unit. His father, a hulking man with hands as large as my head, and his mother, a sinewy, athletic-looking woman, sat constantly at their son's bedside. Michael's father kept telling me about the recurring image he had of his son. He just learned to dance a couple of weeks ago. He would stand by the speakers, bopping up and down with that smile on his face. The few pictures taped up around Michael's bed showed a chortling toddler with dimples so deep they seemed to anchor his cheeks into a permanent smile. My younger brother has the same dimples. Michael had developed acute liver failure after what was thought to be an unremarkable viral illness. He usually would be running from the moment he woke up, but he just kept wanting to lie down and be held, Michael's mother said. After a few days, she noticed that the whites of Michael's eyes had turned yellow. That was when, she said, I got this horrible sinking feeling in my stomach. When Michael probably had no more than a day to live, we received news that a liver was available for him. I had already performed almost 50 other transplant organ procurements by the time I went out to get that liver for Michael, and the operation, with its multitude of steps and enmeshed decision trees, had become pretty routine. But the organs and vessels of children, whether donors or recipients, are so much smaller than an adult's that any slightly imperfect stitch or sloppily placed cut can be disastrous. That night, I hardly noticed the glittering Los Angeles city lights as we flew by helicopter down the Pacific coast. By the time we arrived at the hospital's operating rooms, the nurses had prepared the donor. There was only a strip of flesh extending from the base of the neck to the pubic bone, exposed among the layers of operative drapes. I remember making the incision down that narrow path, my mind straining over the miniaturization. I felt as if I had been dropped into a diminutive china shop and that any inadvertent twist of my wrists would cause everything to shatter. I kept asking for smaller, finer, sharper dissecting scissors, and my neck ached as I struggled to see every detail. My scalp became warm and itchy under the hot OR heating lamps. When we finally removed the liver, a plum-colored organ with surfaces as soft as velvet, I wanted only to close up as quickly as possible. I kept thinking about hurrying back to Michael. With thick black sutures, I lashed together the edges of the gaping incision. After finishing, I nearly tripped over the wiring on the floor as I rushed to leave the OR. "You look awfully awake for this time of the night," one of the nurses commented as I peeled off my bloodied OR gown and stuffed it into the trash bin. I felt relieved and triumphant. Just before leaving, however, I stopped in the operating room once more to pick up a few documents. By now, the nurses had removed the drapes from the body, and I saw a small boy lying naked on the table. The sight of that child, cold and dead under the bright lights, stunned me. I had just had my hands wrist-deep in his belly, but I had never noticed the grass stains on those knobby knees, or the face splattered with orange freckles, or the spiky red halo of hair. A large red tire-patterned abrasion covered the side of his chest, interrupted by several deeply embedded flecks of gravel. His mother, the nurses told me, had been unloading groceries from the car when the boy's 6-year-old sister climbed into the driver's seat and shifted out of park. The boy fell in the path of the front wheels. By the time his mother heard his sister's screams, the boy was breathing irregularly, his upper chest pressed into the gravel driveway by the weight of the car. I saw the long incision and the black stitches I had left. While the rest of his body still bore traces of baby fat, chubby short fingers and rocker feet. His abdomen, which should have been the most soft and round and full, sank down and looked like the emptied cavity it now was. I stood agape. My own chest felt empty, and my head throbbed. I began to wonder what ran through his mother's mind when she came back out of the house and saw him. I wondered how her shrieks and cries rang through the neighborhood, and what the little boy's sister thought when she saw her mother wailing and her brother unresponsive. I wanted for a moment to rip apart those black sutures, to put the organs back, and to shake the dead boy back to consciousness. I wanted to hold his mother, now long gone from the hospital, and apologize that with all my instruments and maneuvers and training, I could not roll back time. On the helicopter ride back along the coast, I forgot about this favorite part of early morning procurements. I did not notice the rising sun reflected in the waves of the Pacific, the dolphins romping below, or the towering Southern California bluffs. I even forgot for a moment about Michael. Instead, all I could think about, all I could see, were the small organs in the cooler next to me and the child I had left behind. Sorry, it's all sort of hard to read that. If anyone has any questions, I would be happy to try and answer them. Yes. Did Michael live? Yes, actually, Michael did very well. The organ, as it turned out, was perfect for him. And he recovered quickly and was dancing again soon. So he did very well. Yes. Yes. This woman's question was how you can remain compassionate in the process of caring for people in difficult situations and not get hardened. I think it's interesting because somewhere along the line, and I think it all goes back to Descartes, if I'm going to blame one person, we seem to believe that our feelings, our emotions, are so separate from our mind, and that we believe, I mean, I'm saying we as a profession, that if we somehow harden ourselves to or distance ourselves from what we see, our dying patients in particular, that we'll do a better job, we'll be able to get the job done. But my belief is actually that it's much, that even at those times when we are hardened or we think we're hardened, we actually feel quite deeply for those that we care for. I know myself that if I didn't feel deeply for these patients, then when I was standing in the operating room at 3 a.m. having to do an operation for somebody, I wouldn't have chosen to be there. I would have chosen to be at home sleeping, to have eaten the meal that I missed because I was working for this patient. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that although as doctors we often try to detach ourselves, I think if we realize that in fact we are always feeling for our patients and that a very deep, profound form of compassion drives us to keep working even despite our own personal needs, if we just recognize that and actually talk about it, I think we would end up being better doctors, not only for our patients but for ourselves. I think part of the problem comes when we try to push it all aside. And for myself, I know that writing these narratives and exploring these topics and recognizing that even at the times when I thought I wasn't being attached in any way. I was. I thought that was very helpful and ultimately made me a better doctor all around, a better person. So one of the things that I hope the book does is encourage those discussions, not only among doctors, but doctors and patients and their families. Yes. This woman's asking about my relationship with writing, if there was something I remembered about it growing up. My earliest memory of writing was, first of all, I was very slow to learn how to speak, and it might have been growing up in a bilingual home, but I remember wanting desperately in kindergarten or first grade to learn how to write words because I had these stories that I had to put down on paper, and it was this pressure I felt. And so the first story I ended up writing was about a princess and a bear, but I had to write them. And then as I was growing up, and it might have been the immigrant family thing, you know, books were a real rarefied thing. And so I don't know if I ever really thought about writing to publish, but certainly stories were a big part of my growing up. My father was a big storyteller, and we learned to write our letters like stories, I guess, from him. So it's been a part of my life, but in ways that I've never called out till you've asked me this question. It's a great question. Yes. That's an interesting question. This woman has asked me why that I felt like a doctor when I pronounced someone dead rather than when I could cure them. I think that was what was so interesting going back to write about that time again and sort of thinking about my feelings back then. I mean, why did I feel so doctorly? Because I had pronounced someone dead. I had made this kind of overarching statement, this person died at 2:08 a.m., and why that made me feel more like a doctor than anything beforehand. In terms of curing, I think it's hard because as medical students, you don't really cure anybody per se. You don't have much of a role, actually, in the actual healing process other than trying to learn. So it was actually sort of the most responsible action I had taken up until then. But I also think it's interesting that we feel most doctorally when we cure or when we make a pronouncement, you know, some kind of diagnostic pronouncement, whether it be death or you have cancer or you have this, when in fact one of the most important things we can do as a doctor is just be with someone. So although medical students, for instance, feel in many ways not empowered in any way because they can't make therapeutic decisions, in fact many of them end up doing the most doctorly things possible, the most important doctorly things possible, and I know we have a medical student in the crowd, and that's just sitting with patients and talking with them and being with them, being present for them. So that's what I hope people reading this book will begin to realize, that there's much more than that we can do than just diagnose and cure. We can be there for our patients. So let me get one from the question from the side, yes? Yeah, you know, I think it is. I think it's to truly becoming a healer or becoming the doctor that we dreamed of becoming. You know, I don't know of any doctor who did not go to medical school and go through all this training not to help people, not wanting to help people in some way. but we lose, I don't know if we lose, well, some of that idealism gets buried or lost, or we learn perhaps in our training that the best way to manifest that is by running to the operating room and getting your patient in the OR and doing things at all cost, even though it may not be the right answer for that family and that particular patient. I hope, though, what this book does is encourage all of us to just think about why we started doing this and how we can sort of get back in touch with that. And it's, I think, my feeling, and maybe I'm being too optimistic or idealistic, is that it's really much more straightforward than we think. It does not require, all it requires is listening and creating an environment for your patients where they feel comfortable to talk and to be able to, opening these discussions up. I think that's the first step. And granted, there are some amazing people in end-of-life care. There's some amazing people in end-of-life care at UVA, actually, who have done, have really started to step forth. Just there are reform efforts now underway that I think are changing our profession. But there's still a ways to go, and I just hope this book helps to support those efforts and maybe even accelerate them. Yes, you're right. Sorry. It's been very inspiring and very affirming, I think, for the most part. From my colleagues, there have been a few comments that have been really wonderful. My mentors have been very supportive. It was interesting, one doctor that I worked very closely with for many years read the book and said, "This is so liberating for me because you are talking about the feelings that I've had all the time and I've never talked about." And what I thought was sort of interesting about that comment, besides being deeply moved by the comment, was that I'd known this person for so long and we had never talked about it with each other. And so if this book is a way, sort of like what my teacher did when she said you have to write these stories, if it's a way that gives us, if it gives us permission to begin talking about these things, I'm thrilled. There have been a couple of comments like, well, hasn't this been done before, or is this ethics or what, So, I still have to believe that those people too, they really want to do the right things by their patients as well. But it's very hard, I think, with going through the training and in the current medical system, which I think has a lot of problems, to even if you're really, really idealistic and you really deeply believe in these things, it's hard to find time, for instance, to talk to your patients. There's an interesting study, and this goes back to the question that you were asking and you were asking about how to maintain the compassion when you practice. There's an interesting study that shows that the average amount of time that doctors spend talking to their patients about advance directives, and those are the legal documents that say what you want at the end of life in terms of medical care, is 5 minutes. So when you read that, it's pretty eye-opening and pretty awful when you think about 5 minutes. But when you put that into the context of the healthcare system, what is the average amount of time doctors have to see patients on a follow-up visit? Because we're assuming that people generally don't talk about this on their first visit, but in follow-up visits. It's about 15 or 20 minutes. So if you think you take 5 minutes and put it in the context of 15 or 20 minutes that are also supposed to be devoted to a history and physical exam, many more things, that it's just, the 5 minutes becomes enormous in that context. So I don't think that I, as one person, can necessarily change those systemic problems. But I do think that I, as an individual, and all of us as individuals, can help to change one small part of that system, and that is how we talk to one another. So, let's see. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, what I'm about to say sounds easy, but I think it's very, very difficult. And I think that is, I'm a big believer in patient advocacy and patient empowerment. And I think that patients and their families, if your doctor or healthcare professional doesn't feel comfortable bringing it up first, which many of us don't, I mean, death, no matter how you look at it, is hard to talk about. But if you can begin that conversation, I think for some healthcare professionals, it'll be a relief to have that initial ice, broken. There will be some that won't be receptive or that will, continue to turn away from the topic. But I think it's your right as a family member or as a patient to decide how you want to die. This is a little bit of an aside, but Art Buchwald's recent death, I think, showed all of us that we have choice in this matter. And I think it's important for all of us to exercise our choice. But I think bringing that topic up would be good, just bringing it up with those people. And if the doctor doesn't listen, talk to the nurse, whatever. Or get them this book. Yes? Actually, I was very, very lucky. My agent and my editor, the editor that read the proposal at Knopf, were both very, very, very enthusiastic. So I was very lucky. I have to say, I was a little anxious about how my professional brethren would read this, because I love medicine and I love my colleagues because they are my brothers, sisters. So I was a little nervous about that, but as things have turned out, it's turned out to be all good. And what was interesting about this actually at the publishers was that that the people within the publishing house also began to talk about their experiences. The book it was really wonderful to see because it was more than I had ever dreamed of. Let me see, there was somebody over here. Yes. The nurses have been, I have to say, have been really some of my best teachers. And I just, as a junior resident, when I was really sort of totally into this culture of medicine, they were the ones that would say, Pauline, you need to talk to the family. Don't forget the family. So I think that's a very, very good suggestion. Excellent one. Yes. Right.
Coming from a medical family, there's two objectives. How do we change the mental mindset? Number one, the notion that compassion and sentimentality and all of those things are a sign of weakness, and that spending more than 15 minutes of your time with a patient, one can't do that in an office that's set up with, to see many, many patients.
I'm not sure exactly, other than through, our system right now it's such a huge monster of a mess. I think the fact that there are sort of voices for healthcare reform out there, I think that's sort of starting to open the door a little bit. But I would definitely say, at least for me, is supporting the efforts that have been started by people in end-of-life care, palliative care experts, people who are looking at different ways to approach it. I as a person would totally support them. And then I think through political change, your legislators, your people that represent you in government, but it's really complex. And I think that change is a long-term change. But I think on the shorter term, and something that is so easy and within our fingertips to do, is just talking about it with one another. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here talking about this is, to me, fantastic. Yes. It's really hard.
That you all must struggle with terribly and somehow learn to deal with that over the course of your career.
This woman was asking about how we deal with our sense of personal responsibility for a patient and how we deal with it over the course of our careers. It's very, very hard. It's probably the most difficult part of doing what we do. That it's interesting because I was in Texas at a Department of Surgery, and I was having a conversation with the chairman there, and he said just that. He said, you know, sometimes I don't think anybody understands how hard this is, he had said that he thought that some of my writing was able to convey just the depth to which you take that responsibility. Sort of looking at it from a different angle, I think it's a very interesting thing, and it ties into the earlier question about compassion and caring for patients and detaching yourself. In our field, in my field, in surgery, and I'll just speak from surgery because I'm most familiar with that, you develop that sense of connection with your patient, not only because of your professional duties, but also because you're literally in that patient with your hands. You know, you are affecting the therapy. And so you really feel, I mean, almost identified with that person, almost to the point where there's a meshing and meshing of your identities. So I think it's very interesting that at the time of death, we push that person so far away, or try to. I think that it would be much healthier for all of us on many respects if we could take that sense of, you know, meshing, and instead of doing this, which I think is somewhat unhealthy as well, but just realize that, you know, we're going to feel for these patients, you know, no matter what, even when we try to push them away, even when we're totally enmeshed with them. So let's just accept that and go with it. And if it gets hard, talk to each other about it, because I think it only hurts. I think it's only hurts to deny it, which is what we end up doing at the end of life. But it is very hard. Yes, sir. Yeah. Right. Yeah, this man was asking what the role of a surgeon is in end-of-life care, and particularly in transplant, for instance, where, yes, there are people on the list, and particularly in livers, where if they don't get the organ, they will not live, they will die. You know, I think surgeons have as good an opportunity as anybody to be with their patients at the end of life. But it's really, I think, a matter of our realizing that we can be as effective as a surgeon by being with them as by just operating. You know, sort of, surgeons are doers, I think. And so our natural instinct is to do something when we see something, like just fix it in some way or move it around. I think if we can sort of step away from that and realize we can be just as effective at fixing things if we just sit by there. And it's interesting because it also depends on the family, obviously. I mean, different patients and different families react very differently to the end of life. And so even beyond just being there, I think all of us can do well by our patients, if we can create a kind of environment for them where not only the patients but their families feel comfortable, no matter what cultural background, what social background, what individual needs, they are comfortable sharing their concerns, their questions, and their joys and their grief with us, and in whatever way makes them most comfortable. There are some families that I've worked with who want every detail of every study on the disease that their loved one has. They want all the numbers, they want the chances, the standard deviations of the expectations. But you know what, if that's important to them, that's important for me to provide for them. That is my duty as their doctor. And then there are other families that just want you to be there by them. But there was one incident, and I hope I can sort of go into another story, but there was one incident that happened in the middle of my surgical training that showed me that it was really sort of the turning point for me. And it was a surgeon that showed me this and showed me that there was more that I could do than just cure. It was in the middle of my training, and I was taking care of a businessman who had colon cancer that had spread to the rest of his body. It was metastatic. And I went around on him every day, and every day his wife would pull me aside, and she'd ask, well, when can we bring my husband home? She was fully aware that he was at the end of his life, and she and he had wanted him to die at home. And I would say, well, we're going to try to get him better. But eventually, he just got worse, and we had to transfer him to the ICU. One night when I was on call in the middle of the night, it became pretty apparent to me that this gentleman was not going to last more than a couple of hours. So I called his wife, and I called his attending surgeon, and they both came in, and his wife was obviously she was in tears. And I brought the attending surgeon and the wife to the patient's room. Now, one of the things that you learn fairly early on in your training, and this is part of what sociologists have referred to as the hidden curriculum of medicine. It's sort of the culture of medicine, the little gestures and behaviors that you learn that sort of shape your value system or shape how you approach end-of-life care. Well, one of the things I had learned, and I learned very well, was that when patients are dying in the ICU, you bring the families there, and then you leave them alone, because what we had come to believe, what we convinced ourselves of, was that these families needed their privacy. So I brought the surgeon and his wife to the room, and then I turned around, fully expecting the attending surgeon to come with me. So I was in the middle of my residency. I got out, and I was the only one who had left the room. And I thought, oh, God, this is a little weird. So I waited out there, still sort of waiting for the surgeon to come out, because I expected him to come out pretty quickly. But he didn't. So I looked in, and what I saw when I looked back in that room was the thing that changed my view of what I could do. I'll never forget it. He was standing by the woman, and he was pointing up at the monitors, and he was explaining to her how the last signs of life, what they look like. And then he pointed to her husband's chest and was explaining how breathing at the end of life changes. Not to be frightened by the sounds, it just changes. And then he told her that her presence there at her husband's side, even though he seemed to not be conscious, comforted him. And I thought of that. I didn't go into the room. They all came out about 30 minutes later when the man died. And the woman, about a couple weeks after that, wrote me a note thanking us for having allowed her husband to die a dignified death. It wasn't at home as they had wished, but it was a dignified death, just as they had wished. And I never forgot that moment. I thought about that moment every time I had a terminal patient that I cared for from that moment on. And I can't say that I ever or always or sometimes or whatever did as wonderful a job as that surgeon did, but I always tried to do what that surgeon did. It was, I think it's important. I think, you know, medicine is so full of things over which you have no control. you know, so so I think it's really important to try your best. It's a human endeavor, but if you try your best, I think you can do a lot of good. So sorry, long answer for a question.
I would encourage all of you to continue to talk to Pauline up here at the front as she's signing your book. They are available here at the front, and she will be here available to sign, and as I said, to continue the conversation. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank